Well, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Bart Cusco as we talk about artificial intelligence, brain implants, and so much more. And we'll take your calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. This hour we'll take your calls with Bart Cusco as we talk about incredible things done with technology and also things that aren't so incredible that they could use with technology. Bart, you recommend fasting, but what you call noise fasting. Tell me what you say about that.
Silence is golden, George. I do recommend it. And I discuss the effects, mainly negative, of noise in my book called Noise. Noise has the effect on our hormonal systems to raise them, to stimulate them. Why? Because we evolved, our ancestors evolved in very quiet environments. That's not the environment of today. The environment of today is loud. It's high decibel. It increases stress. It affects your sleep. And it's only getting worse, not better. So I recommend, if you can, at least once a month, get away from the cell phone, go somewhere quiet. You can do it in a room, but you can do it more exotically, like those of us here in California, out in the desert. I prefer the mountains, and go into what I call deep silence, deep quiet, and just the calm, just to think your thoughts, maybe with another person, maybe not. It's not a form, say, of meditation. It's just kind of resetting some of those hormonal and cognitive variables back to our hunter-gatherer ancestry, back to normal. The only downside I've seen with it, George, is when you come off of it and you come back to the world of stimulation and honking horns and people jabbering into the smartphones. But we are overstimulated in a variety of avenues, including visually, but also sonically. And it's only getting worse.
Can some noise, though, benefit you?
That is an interesting answer, yes. That's an interesting property. We originally called that stochastic resonance, or SR. And it goes like this. In the classical systems of engineering, there are what we call linear systems, where the output is directly proportional to the input. And in those systems, noise is always bad. Noise always harms the system. You know, in radio, we talk about the signal-to-noise ratio. But when we talk about real-world systems, they're not linear. They're nonlinear. You can think about it this way. A linear system's like a sheet of paper. It's smooth. And if you crumple up that paper, that's a nonlinear system. And if you zoom in real close to the crumple, it looks kind of flat. And sure enough, for about a half a century or more in the 20th century, we did that kind of thing. It's called a linear approximation. We only recently saw that nonlinear systems, in general, benefit from a little bit of noise. And that includes what you're listening to now on the radio. That includes a lot of other things. You can actually improve how you perceive images by adding a little bit of noise sometimes, and many other things. And it looks as if, since this is true of every known model of a neuron, whether it's in your foot or your brain, that there is some optimal level of noise. Why? Because neurons work in an on-off way, brain cells, nerve cells, and so they're nonlinear. It looks as if nature has figured this out, as it would have over a billion years of evolution, to tune our parameters to an optimal level of noise. Again, not a lot of noise, but even a little bit, even coming out of a noise fast, it can energize you. It can actually, in that sense, it appears, maybe make you a little smarter.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's no question if you understand it and you're a musician and a composer, different kinds of music can inspire you, get you excited, get you going. Other kinds of music, let the hair on the back of your head stand up.
Exactly. If you just think about this, you and I having this conversation now in quiet versus doing it in a restaurant where there's different levels of background noise. Most of those background noise levels will interfere with the conversation.
Right.
But there's an optimal level in there, George, that will maximally, in effect, excite you and I. It may be hard to find, but we know that's there. It's called stochastic resonance. If anybody's interested, go to my webpage. I post these papers. I, in general, don't take funding from the government. Most of these don't involve patents. And you can just see the plots. It looks like an inverted U. If you add a little bit of noise, the performance gets better. Too much noise, it goes away. So one of the great design problems of the future is how to design systems and artificial systems, AI systems, to maximally benefit from noise.
Bart, were you familiar with the work of the late Japanese scientist Dr. Emoto? This is an amazing story. He would take water, and he would bombard it with what we would call pleasant music and then harsh music. And of course, to everybody, there's a different definition there. But generally speaking, softer music versus harsher music. And then he would freeze the water and look under it at a microscope, with a microscope. All the music that was soft and pleasant that bombarded the water crystal that he looked under a microscope at looked symmetry and gorgeous. I mean, it looked like diamonds in a cluster. And then the frozen water slide that he looked at that was bombarded with loud noise music was scattered everywhere. It was unbelievable. It was almost as if the water had a brain of its own and reacted to the music.
Yeah, that's interesting, because at the level of water molecules, the world is inherently noisy. We don't see that at our macroscopic level. The quantum level is nothing but noise. And so adjusting, there's probably a noise level in there that helps the crystalline configuration. I'm guessing. I don't know the results here. But we know that in general, and we can use that in a variety of other techniques. We're using it now, for example, in models of what we call simulated annealing, which is kind of like that. Annealing comes from metallurgy, where you melt the metal down and recast it into a samurai sword, or melt the sand down and recast it into glass, which is a low-energy crystalline configuration. You have to melt it very slowly. That technique, so-called simulated annealing, is really the only technique we have now, George, for searching very high-dimensional surfaces. Now, what I mean by that is something like an egg carton or a mountain range, except you have thousands or millions or trillions of variables, like, for example, trying to tune the genome. And so to do that, we have to find low-cost areas, low-cost valleys in those mountain ranges. And we do it by, in effect, heating the system up so the ball bounces a lot, and as it cools down, it bounces less. We've been able to show, prove mathematically, and file a patent on, that there's an optimal way of doing that with noise. In other words, you can always, in theory, do it better, always search the surface better, always find better, in this case, genetic solutions or any others, with the right secret sauce noise than without it.
Here's a bizarre question. If you're able to download memory onto a chip and then implant it, and then you basically have your memory and you live forever, what happens, Bart, if you took that memory chip and put it in a dog? Would you become the dog?
You become the dog. Absolutely.
Or a turtle, or whatever you wanted to do with it.
Absolutely. Or the other way around. You could go that way. You know, and to give credit to science fiction authors who I think were there first with imagination, the great Robert Silverberg in the 60s put out a book like this called To Live Again, where people, in effect, pay a fee, and they house several people's digital souls, in effect, in their brain. But in theory, you could do that if you were downloaded into a chip.
Jeez. Let's go to the phones. Dave in New Jersey, start us off, David. Go ahead.
Hey, George, I don't know if you remember the Star Trek episode called Spock's Brain.
Yes, Spock, I do.
Spock had his brain taken out by an alien.
Exactly.
And McCoy had to go synapse by synapse to get him working properly. I just wanted to bring that up. Also, many years ago, I went to my dentist. He took a full head x-ray, and he came back looking a little disturbed. He said, have you ever had brain surgery? I said, no, and I hadn't as of yet. But the day after that, I was supposed to get an MRI. The night before, I had a visitation, and I knew the implant was gone.
Wow. Wow. And you said you haven't had didn't have a brain operation at that time. Have you since?
I had it afterwards. I had hydrocephalitis.
Oh, okay. How are you doing now?
I'm doing great.
Good for you. Good for you.
It was weird. My sister had it the same time I did.
It's not genetic.
No, I know.
That's interesting. Strange timing on something like that.
George, I think I recall that episode of Star Trek.
Oh, it was way ahead of time.
Yeah, Bones is all ready to do the operation. He's laughing about how simple it appears, and then his ability to do that starts to slip, and away it goes. It's not so clear that he can do the operation. But the kind of operation you need, that's in effect a head transplant or brain transplant. And there have been people attempting that, some Russian efforts and many others. You can see those online. But that would require the nanosurgery of the future. We're far from there now.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big story about a year ago that they wanted to transplant a head onto another body.
You know, in theory,
crazy.
In theory, you could do it. You can't do it today with our devices and surgical precision, but at some point you could do it and maybe regraft it or regenerate it through stem cells. There's a lot of promise there. But a wholesale brain transplant, that's a ways off.
That is a ways off, but it may be doable one day.
In theory, it's possible.
I mean, look, 100 years ago, if you were to tell people what we're doing today medically, they would think you were nuts.
That's right. I mean, if they looked up and saw an airplane.
Oh, all that. Or we're going to go to the moon.
Or that we complain about paying a couple $100 to fly from one coast to the other. Who would have thought that was possible?
Let's go to Bernadette, first-time caller in South Holland, Illinois. Hi, Bernadette. Good morning.
Good morning, George. Okay, I'm somewhat cheating. This is Bernadette that used to call you from St. Petersburg, Florida.
Oh, you moved.
But it's been since 2015, but I just discovered you here. Oh, my God. Let me just first say that it is true that when the student is ready, the teachers show up. I am so excited about your guest tonight and your information that you're disseminating.
Oh, he's one of the best.
Okay. You know what? There's something to this, and my question is, can people be allergic? Maybe there's a better word, but I notice when I walk into a room where there's a lot of technology, and mind you, I worked in offices for years, and I never felt this. But now when I go to a lady's house that has a big screen TV, her computer, and just a lot of technology, and I almost feel like I want to faint. And
that answer to you, Bernadette, is absolutely true, that people can be bombarded by waves. And I'll let you jump in on that, Bart, but that could happen.
Absolutely. And, for example, we're affected by blue light differently than other lights, and that's an issue when we look at computer screens too much. The other thing is, since the brain is an electromagnetic device, we just don't know a lot about what happens when you surround it with a random barrage of different kinds of electric fields. Maybe nothing, maybe a little bit, maybe subtle, and people are very different on this, but it's certainly possible.
Bart, what do you think overall of artificial intelligence, good or bad?
I think it's good, but it's a tool, and like most tools, it can be abused. And when you think of AI, most people tend to fill in with movies. Let me give you what I think is one of the best examples of AI. It doesn't get any credit, but it's getting better by the day, and that is your nightly weather forecast. If you look at that weather map, the latest ones with the pressure centers and the fields flowing, you're seeing the heart of modern computation. The better word than AI, we call it engineering computational intelligence. And the heart of it, George, is something called Monte Carlo, like the city. If you just give me a minute, what we're doing in AI and in most engineering applications like this is we're what we call averaging the future. We're trying to go a little bit out. And so when you see those predictions of the hurricane, they start out very accurate, then here's what it would be a day away or 2 days away, and you see what are called spaghetti plots. Those are based on random simulations. If I can give you a quick history.
And what they can't predict is the velocity it hits at this point, but they sure know where it's going to go.
Right. The general trend, you can see it expanding. But the history of this is the H-bomb. And it's the greatest genius, in my opinion, maybe of all times, but certainly of the 20th century, a guy named John von Neumann. And he's working on the H-bomb in 1947 at Los Alamos. This is 2 years after World War II has ended. They're working on the so-called super with a guy named Stanislav Ulam, who used to be a math professor at my school at USC, among other places. And Ulam's playing a game of solitaire and says, could I work out the future of that mathematically? Too hard. Then he has an idea. Well, I got this great big computer running, the ENIAC and then the MANIAC. What if I simulated different solitaire games, did it thousands or millions of times, and then took the average? And they gave it the name of Monte Carlo, which was the main gambling facility at the time. That is the basis today, not just of modeling thermodynamic effects, which is what that was about, but really an AI. And it's the fundamental result that when we try to figure out what we call an expected value, for example, modern derivatives pricing in modern finance, which is very complicated, it turns out those prices are averages. And the only way in general we can estimate them, just like with the hurricane, is with a version of von Neumann Monte Carlo averaging. And it's averaging out into the future. And it's getting better all the time. And so if we can for example, predict how the next word in a sentence, which is another application of this from the 50s and 60s, then we can predict the next price, for example, in a stock trade a few seconds out, maybe a few minutes out. And there are hedge funds, George, that do nothing but this.
That's right.
Massive computation. But it goes way beyond that. And what it takes for that weather forecaster to make that pretty accurate prediction of tomorrow's max and min temperatures is computational intelligence at its best. It's predictive science, and it's getting more powerful in the sense we can go a little further out, all the way out with our climate models, which also use Monte Carlo, as they have to. And that's where we are.
Next up, let's go to Terry in Toronto, Canada. Hi, Terry.
Hi there, George.
Good to have you with us again.
Good to hear your voice and your guest. George, I want to bring your attention. Back in 1969, at 14 years of age, under the guise of treating epilepsy, I underwent a top-secret experiment by some people in Toronto. And I look at my x-rays from Toronto General and St. Mike's, and I got 43 metallic implants in the cerebral cortex. No consent, no explanation or anything. I'm simply dumbfounded. But I'm wondering if implants are also used for brain tissue transplants.
That's a good question. I don't know, Bart.
I'm not aware of that at present, but I think that will come. We have a problem, George, of getting chips to talk to flesh. I said that today the best supercomputer, the IBM Summit supercomputer, is about a billion operations flops per second. And that's about what the brain does. But that is not an issue. That's not how it works when we try to get the chip to talk to the neurons or vice versa. The first instance, really, that we mentioned before the earlier break was my colleagues at USC and elsewhere who've been able to stimulate part of the hippocampus during training. We've got a long way to go with that. But at some point, the talking between flesh and chip will be quite fluent, and you'll be able to encode specific information besides just stimulation intensity.
How dramatic. Bart, if people want to get a hold of you, email you, website, what do they do?
Easy on the email, George. I get a little too much of it as is.
Okay, but they
my website's publicly available, and I do present a sequence of papers, and I'll be releasing many more on my website that people are welcome to download.
Not
just mathematical papers, there are also some philosophical papers.
When is the re-release of NanoTime?
I believe it's going to be at the end of the year.
That sounds like an exciting thriller, too.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's odd to have a book that publishers came to me and said, we think it's popular and that we want to bring it back. Sure.
That happens. It's all timing, isn't it?
It sure is.
Well, Bart, we're going to take a quick break in just a moment. We'll come back with some final phone calls and questions for you. In your opinion, 20 seconds or less, where are we headed the next 5 years with technology?
More of the same and bigger problems with privacy.
Probably real big problems.
Absolutely.
I think so. Hacking and everything else, it's out of control right now, and it's getting worse. It really is. Well, stay with us. Bart Costco with us here on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to come back in just a moment with final phone calls. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. I want to push those numbers high. And follow us on Twitter as well. We shall be back. And welcome back. Our final segment with Bart Costco as we take your phone calls. He is a professor, PhD, of course. And he is the doctor. He is a professor of electrical engineering and law at the University of Southern California and an award-winning pioneer and author in the machine learning fields of artificial intelligence and neural networks. What do you think comes first, Bart? The bigger breakthroughs in AI or the neural network technology?
They're pretty much the same these days, George. Neural networks used to be considered separate from AI. For example, I organized the first IEEE international conference in 1987. We call that the Big Bang of popular neural networks. And in those days, it was very separate. Neural networks was on the electrical engineering side. AI was on the computer science side. Today, they have fully merged. But there's a problem. What neural networks do and do real well is recognize patterns. They work and affect at the subconscious level. But what they don't do is reason well. And that's the next step in AI, where we can go beyond merely recognizing patterns like your face in an image or looking at a cancer pattern in a display on the screen, go to, from that to intelligent reasoning, way beyond what we have today.
And it's just the way the technology is moving is amazing. What is fueling the rapid speed of it? What's happening?
At the computer level, it's the rapid increase in chip density. That is to say, the on-off circuits, something called Moore's Law, it was doubling about every 18 months or 2 years. It slowed down a little bit, but it's still continuing, and some version of it will continue for a long time. So a lot of what you're seeing today is simply very, very old algorithms, especially, for example, neural networks, running on vastly faster computers.
Are there other countries that are keeping pace with us in this arena?
Oh, absolutely.
There are.
China, for example, is maybe not at the forefront, but it is certainly trying. It has, I think, a superior educational infrastructure. Russia is another company.
How about India? I think India is rapid.
India is, you know, it still has that British system, and they have this wonderful system called the Indian Institute of Technology, IIT. We all scramble to hire IIT PhD students, and it trains well, and it has a lot of entrepreneurs. But between those two countries, George, India and China, you've got a third of the planet. And many other countries are far ahead. Europe, for example, Britain. So it's not just a U.S. game anymore. It's worldwide.
Part Apple says that's going to stop revealing individual sales of its iPhones, its iPads, and things like that. They're, you know, afraid technology is beginning to slow down. How much more can you keep changing things? My gosh.
A lot. An awful lot.
Really?
Absolutely. Again, most of the algorithms that we have don't scale up. This is another problem. They run into what we call the curse of dimensionality. And it's one of the few things that works and keeps working is that what I mentioned before the break, Monte Carlo. It doesn't depend upon the number of dimensions. So, for example, in finance, if you have a portfolio with a few stocks and bonds, it's very difficult predicting its future. As you add more stocks and bonds to that, the dimensionality increases. It becomes much more difficult. And without a simulation technique like Monte Carlo, enhanced by computers, we would be pretty much at a loss already. So that's going to continue. But the next great leap is when we go from, in effect, the subconscious of AI, where we are now, to more of the conscious part. And fuzzy logic, by the way, is a very big part of that.
Other than, of course, like with my smartphone, I can text, I can call, I can go online, I can look at the internet, I can email. What more do I want to do?
Well, one thing you want to do is have image recognition. So when you go shopping, you come out of the store and you say, where did I park my car? You've lost your car, and you want to hold up your smartphone so it can scan the parking lot and recognize your car or similar cars. Now, that's a very tough computational problem. But it is something that's feasible, and it's something we can do right now if the computers go fast.
Well, as a matter of fact, there's a company that has that where you can you get a little device from them, which you keep in your cigarette lighter in your car, and then you get the app, and you turn the app on, and it finds your car for you.
Right. But beyond that, just the ability to walk through the shopping mall and to recognize different kinds of objects, that's something that's beyond the current capability, but it's coming. And what's in your smartphone, I think, will likely be in some form embedded in your retina. That's where this is headed, I believe.
And look at the brains behind this stuff. You know, beyond Facebook and what they've done for, you know, social networking, whether you like it or not, look at the technology of Uber, for example. You know, I love our cab drivers. We got lots of cab drivers who listen to our program. Yet Uber technology has really hurt the cab business. In more ways than one. But, I mean, what amazing technology, Bart. You could literally see the car of the driver coming to pick you up.
Correct.
Going down the road, making a turn, stopping, and then you see it coming down with its lights on if it's at night, and you go, whoop, there it is, and you look at your phone and it matches it. I mean, my gosh, who came up with that?
A lot of people did that. Also depends on GPS. But what we really wanted for decades are smart cars that you can just sit in the back and...
I don't want to do that.
Well, you don't want to do it now, George. But in the future, I think you will want to.
And I definitely, because of jobs, I don't want to see a driverless truck.
I think that's a very long way off. There will still be truck drivers. I think to the first approximation, this will assist them in what they do. it'll drive more efficiently. But to take something like Uber, the smart car, and many other devices, there is an inevitable automation here. And so some jobs will inevitably be lost or reduced, and many, many others will be created.
What's next for smart technology? I mean, I didn't think of Uber. It didn't even cross my mind. As a matter of fact, it was a couple of years ago, some people in Los Angeles said, hey, we're going to take an Uber home. And I went, what's that? I mean, they knew about it way before I did. And then it started catching on, and it turned out to be huge. They even started advertising on our program a year ago.
There's something else, George, that is coming. We have a forerunner, and that's what's called blockchain. And the great example of that is Bitcoin,
which okay.
came into existence almost exactly 10 years ago with this anonymous genius that goes by the name of Satoshi Nakamoto. We got to know who he is so we can give this guy a Nobel Prize in economics.
But who's probably worth $100 billion. He's probably worth more than Jeff Bezos from Amazon.
He could well be. But he introduced something, or they introduced something, whoever Satoshi is, that is truly radical in the smart world, the idea of a secure ledger. If I want to sell my house to you or vice versa, you have, and I go through an escrow. We have a trusted third party.
Mm-hmm.
Blockchain gets rid of that. It's an open ledger, and yet it's cryptographically secure. And that's something secure, severely lacking in not just implants and devices like that, but really in all of our communications.
Can you trust it?
Oh, I think you can trust blockchain, because in order to outsmart it, you would need vast computational facilities. And that's one of the genius things about it. But blockchain has many, many of their applications. In fact, it's one of the ways to boost the security of the Internet of Things. But no one saw that coming. And just think about it. We have a currency out there. Actually, there's more than one. But just to take Bitcoin, that has no government behind it.
Nothing.
A lot of governments were quite suspicious of it. It hasn't been perfect. You know, you and I can't walk into a store in general and purchase coffee with Bitcoin, and a lot of criminals use it. I understand that, but it's amazing, George, that this thing exists at all and persists after 10 years and a lot of attempts to bring it down. That is pretty radical, and it promises something that we're severely lacking with the internet and social media.
Yeah, it is amazing. Let's go to Jim in Portland, Oregon. Get us started here. Jim, go ahead, Jim.
Oh, hi, Bart. Hi, George.
Hey.
I had a scary thought in the first hour when you were talking about learning in a chip, and it would be, what if a patient had a chip with political beliefs implanted, and he couldn't transcend it, and to some extent his free will is distorted, and what if those political beliefs are pathological? It was a scary thought, and I never quite got over it, so I thought I'd call.
You would vote for someone, and they tell you who to vote for, Bart.
Oh, you bet. I think that's an unfortunate immediate application. We have it in some form now, fake news, as you mentioned before. But again, we talked about robocalls, and there are going to be a lot more of those. And the ability to interfere with your wireless communications and inject something like that, that's a problem. And this is just the sort of thing where not just cryptology, but its application in the blockchain can help.
That's why I'm opposed to voting with your smartphone. I think that's dangerous, don't you?
It is dangerous today, but in theory, we can make that secure. But it's a long ways off.
It is a long ways off. Deborah in Savannah, Georgia is with us. Hi, Deb. Go ahead.
How you doing?
Okay. I hope you are, too.
I am, but I'm on your topic. I'll tell you what gave me pause is I don't know if you, either of you or whomever, saw any of the Homeland series, excellent series on television.
Yeah, I've seen a couple, yeah.
Okay, there was one episode where the terrorist wanted to knock out, you know, one of the guys in disguise that they wanted to rid of had a pacemaker. So they broke into his library when he wasn't there, opened the safe, got the code to his pacemaker, turned that, because it has every pacemaker has a code, turned that over to the hacker, and, you know, the guy was giving a speech or something, and they started, the hacker started playing with the different, you know.
His heart was going into arrhythmia, huh?
Exactly. He started going up, and anyway, the guy had a massive heart attack right there, done, and that really gave me pause. I'll tell you.
That is real, Bart, isn't it?
It is real, and that's just the thing we're worried about in tampering with people's implants and the wireless connections from the local area network to the internet. Again, it's in theory something that we can protect reasonably well with enough cryptography and maybe some kind of quantum cryptography, but we're not there yet.
is this wireless, these devices in the heart, for example?
My understanding is yes, they are. Like, for example, the Watchman, and there's a wireless feed to usually your smartphone, and that goes to a central server. Then your physician looks at that on a daily or weekly basis, or if there's an emergency alert, if there's an arrhythmia or something else. But absolutely, it's a wireless connection.
Let's go to first-time caller John in Whitmore Lake, Michigan. Hey, John, go ahead.
Hey, Bart, George.
Hey there.
Really great to talk to you.
Thank you.
I'm just wondering, tinnitus is one of those things that nobody can quite figure out. Doctors, it doesn't matter if you're a psychiatrist or a regular doctor, they just can't figure it out. And is there anything you think they're going to come up with that can actually keep that buzz out of somebody's head, because it drives people nuts, they can't sleep. It's just an awful, awful thing. It's just makes their life miserable.
It's not fun. Do you have it, John?
Bart? No. Actually,
good.
My girlfriend does.
Yeah, it's frustrating,
God,
isn't
I don't.
And
you know, she can't sleep, and so it makes her very, very out there a little bit, and not to be the person that she should be.
I think that's part of the eardrum, and also, is it not the brain, Bart?
That's right, the auditory cortex. So in theory, we could do some surgery to fix that. But I do recall reading a study, George, I believe from Dr. Charles Brenner, that there have been preliminary experiments with the molecule nicotinamide riboside to ameliorate that. But I'd have to check that.
It is frustrating to hear that kind of sound, that constant whining. It would drive you nuts, wouldn't it? Especially on a very quiet night. Like you say, go out to the desert. If you have tinnitus, you're going to go crazy.
You're going to have a tough time on a noise fast.
You sure
do. There
are
a lot of smart people working on that problem.
Let's take a few more calls with Bart Costco here before he is done for the night. You're getting ready for Thanksgiving. It's a couple weeks away now, Bart.
I sure am.
My gosh, fast year, isn't it?
Has been indeed.
Let's go to Bob in Connecticut. Bob, it's your turn.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you today?
Fine. Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Costco, I'm sitting right now 12 feet away from two smart meters on the outside wall. One is for the house, one is for the garage. Now, about 10 years ago, I was normal, as we should say it. All of a sudden, I started getting all sorts of issues. I had lethargy, I had sleep issues, depression. Occasionally, I would get this like electronic buzz in my ears for a few seconds. I don't know if they were scanning them as they're going by or whatever. Loss of appetite. I rarely leave the house. And this just started. Even my wife said, "What happened? You know, what's going on with you? You know, you were outside. I was working at your Trans Ams, and you know, you're going here, there. I don't even want to leave the house." And I was thinking, you know, it's got to be the smart meters. So I remember George had a gentleman on. It may have been you. Was talking about the smart meter problem, and I'm also having problems with the utility about as far as throwing on a Faraday cage on those things, having them removed, you know, et cetera, the whole nine yards, thinking of going legal on them. But what is your opinion on the smart meters?
In general electrical devices, we only have associational studies. We don't really have what we want. We call RCTs, randomized controlled trials, where we can make real cause and effect predictions. So I don't know, and I don't think anyone else does either.
There are a lot of waves out there, though, Bart, aren't there? They're bombarding us from every direction.
Again, they're electric waves, electromagnetic waves. Your brain is an electromagnetic device, so there's potential for interaction.
Have you ever stood underneath a high wire?
I don't feel comfortable with that.
No. You can hear it buzzing.
Yes.
You know,
but I see birds that perch up there, and they seem to do fine.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, Bart Costco's with us. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. He's got several books out there, including The Fuzzy Future, Noise, Heaven and a Chip, and, of course, his book Nanotime is coming out again in Nanotime. Bart, thanks. Keep in touch with us. You're one of my faves.
Thank you, George. It was fun.
Bart Costco, and he came to us years ago with the theory of fuzzy logic, all about technology and everything else. Well, up next, Lon Milo Duquette joins us with his theories on magic in the tarot cards, and he's got a new book out. We'll talk about that as well when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.